Today we're going to study the first 17 verses of Exodus chapter 4. The title of today's lesson is Complain, 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 Comply. Let's recall what God has asked Moses to do back in chapter 3, verse 10. In that verse, God said to Moses, "Therefore, come now, and I'll send you to Pharaoh, so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt." So God has said, go to Pharaoh, bring up the sons of Israel out of Egypt, and take them into the wilderness. This is the commission that God has given to Moses on Mount Horeb. Now, you suppose that being blessed with the experience of a theophany, that is, an appearance of God to a man in which he directly speaks to Moses, and he does so from this burning bush that we studied a few weeks ago. Do you suppose that to be told the very name of God by the very lips of God, and then being assured that this self-existent God who created the universe will accompany Moses on his mission, you think to be personally commissioned in this fashion by God for the leadership role in the single most significant event in the history of Israel, the Exodus, you think that would be enough for Moses to proceed with what God has commissioned him to do without complaining?
No.
Well, as we'll see in today's passage, apparently not. Apparently that's not quite enough for Moses. You know what Moses' problem is? I do. I know exactly what his problem is. Moses does not have a degree in systematic theology from Dallas Theological Seminary. That's his problem. You see, we all know that the mere possession of that little piece of paper, that document that says, "You did it," well, that's the answer to everything theological. If only he had a diploma from Dallas Seminary, he would know all the answers to all those questions that we like to refer to as mysteries. And he would know Hebrew. That's a really cool talent to have if you're going to write the Pentateuch. See, if Moses had a degree from the seminary, he would already know that God takes very unlikely men, and he uses his spirit to empower these men to do great things. If Moses had a degree from Dallas Seminary, there would be no Exodus 3:11. The Exodus scroll would go straight from Exodus 3:10 to Exodus 3:12, and that phrase in there, "Who am I that I should go," would have never been written if he only had a degree from Dallas Seminary. Moses just doesn't understand the doctrines of anthropology and pneumatology, because then he would know that even though man is flawed, God's Spirit can empower a man to do things under the power of the Almighty God. And you know what? If you think about it, his eschatology is really weak, and if there is any problem Dallas Theological Seminary can fix, it's an eschatology problem. Dallas Seminary is the pinnacle of pre-tribulational, pre-millennial, dispensational eschatology. I practice saying that out loud. I don't normally practice resisting. If his eschatology were right, Moses would have picked up immediately what God meant when he kept repeating that phrase, "I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob." He would know that God was affirming his covenant with Abraham and that he was affirming all those promises that he had made over the years to the patriarchs. He would certainly connect the covenant with the land of Canaan. That's a central feature of eschatology. And he would know that because God is true, the Exodus and the conquest are going to be successful. And instead of, "Who am I that I should go?" he would know that there's nothing to worry about. And because one of God's attributes is absolute veracity, something he would have learned in his systematic theology class, he would know that God cannot lie. And that if God makes a promise, God keeps it. You see, Dallas has whole departments on this stuff. You can have an entire department at the seminary on each one of these little points. But most importantly, this I don't want you to miss. If Moses had gone to Dallas Theological Seminary, all those personal disobedience problems that he has would have been gone for the rest of his life. He would have probably gotten to go into the Promised Land, and he wouldn't have died on Mount Nebo on the wrong side of the river. This is all related to not being a graduate. Dallas Theological Seminary. For those of you who know me, you know I'm being facetious. For those of you who don't, I'm being facetious. Moses didn't need a seminary education, because the problem Moses has is not a problem that can be solved with a seminary education. You see, Moses had the same problem Adam had. God said to Adam, "If you disobey me, you'll die." Satan said, "No, you won't." And Adam believed Satan, and he didn't believe God. Let me say this another way. Moses didn't believe the word of God. It's that simple. And there's a great example in the New Testament that exemplifies just the opposite reaction to the word of God, the reaction that Moses should have had when God called him. And it's an instructive section here that shows us how he should have responded to the commission, and by extrapolation, how we should respond when God calls us to do something. The Apostle Paul in Acts 27 is on a ship. He's bound for Rome. And he's set to appear before Caesar. And there was this great storm that came along, and it was so bad that it created great fear among the sailors, and to the man, they thought they were dead. But in Acts 27, verses 23 and 24, the angel of God comes to Paul, and he says to him, "You are appointed to appear before Caesar, and God has granted to you and to all those who are sailing with you safe passage." So Paul goes to the men who are terrified, the sailors. And he says to them, here's what God said, and he tells them what God has told him. And then he concluded with these words. He says, "Therefore, relax. For I believe God that it will turn out exactly as he has said." You see, there's the difference. I believe God. That's the difference. If Moses had accepted his commission from God with the same spirit that Paul accepted his, all these problems that Moses faced in his life could have been avoided. So, you suppose maybe there's a lesson for us? Let's look at the first section that we're going to look here at today. There, I wrote complaint up here. This is actually very important the way I did this. There are three complaints that we're going to read about today. So I've written the word up there three times. That'll help you remember that. The first complaint is going to be in verses 1 through 9 of chapter 4. So let's read those together right now. "Then Moses said, 'What if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? For they may say, the Lord has not appeared to you.'" This is his concern when he goes back to speak to the elders of Israel. "And the Lord said to him, 'What's that in your hand?' He says, 'A staff.' Then he said, 'Throw it on the ground.' So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from it. But the Lord said to Moses, 'Stretch out your hand and grasp it by its tail.' So he stretched out his hand, and he caught it, and it became again a staff in his hand." And here's the purpose for this demonstration: "That they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you." Then the Lord furthermore said to him, "Now put your hand into your bosom." He put his hand into his bosom. This probably means just into his cloak. When he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then he said, "Put your hand into your bosom again." And so he put his hand into his bosom again, and when he took it out, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. It shall come about that if they will not believe you or heed the witness of the first sign, they may believe the witness of this last sign. But it shall be that if they will not believe even these two signs, or heed what you say, then you shall take some water from the Nile River, pour it on the dry ground, and the water which you take from the Nile River will become blood on the dry ground. We're going to begin our exegesis here by looking at this first complaint of Moses and God's response. You'll remember that in chapter 3, Moses had three major doubts about what God was asking him to do. He doubted his own eyes when he saw the burning bush because it wasn't being consumed by the fire. He doubted himself, namely his own ability to do what God was asking him. And he doubted that he would have a good reception when he went back to Egypt and told the elders of Egypt that God had appeared to him, even though God had revealed a special name by which he would identify him to the people. Here in 3:18, God has already said to Moses, when you go back and when you say that the God of your fathers has appeared to me, he said, they will believe you. He's already told him that. They'll believe you. They will believe I appeared to you, and they will believe that I sent you. When we get to the first verse of chapter 4, Moses essentially says, no, they won't. Now, most of you probably have a translation that goes something like this. Well, what if they won't believe me when I get back there? There's a way to say what if in Hebrew. That's not what this says. This says, literally, God has said, they'll believe you, 3:18. In 4:1, the text simply says, behold, they will not believe me, and they will not listen to my voice. In other words, in the Hebrew text, it's not hypothetical. What if? It is a declarative statement. They won't believe me, no matter what you've said. This is where Moses has begun to move from normal human reactions to being assigned a great responsibility to an attitude of defiance. God knows that Moses had a bad experience back when he was a young man in Egypt, and maybe that knowledge has kept God from being too upset with Moses even through this last complaint. You'll remember back in chapter 2 when Moses tried to help an innocent Israelite who was in a confrontation with one of his brethren, and he confronted him. The man who was in the wrong said, who made you a prince and a judge over us? And I said at that time, that's what they call a proliptic statement. It's a flash-forward statement in microcosm form to something bigger that's going to happen later. So when Moses is trying to assist this Hebrew who's being wronged by his brother, it is a flash-forward picture of the Exodus when he will come to help the entire nation of Israel. God knows this. Nevertheless, there's nothing in Moses' experience that legitimizes the response that he has to God. But God is gracious, and instead of a rebuke, he gives Moses three signs which Moses will be able to use to persuade the elders of Israel. The first sign is what we might call the sign of the serpent. The Lord asks Moses a question. He says, what's that in your hand? And he says, well, it's a staff. And of course, Moses is a shepherd, so he would have a shepherd's staff in his hand. God says, cast it to the ground. Moses obeyed. When the staff hit the ground, it became a serpent. It became what in Hebrew is known as a nahash. When we were in Israel, we climbed up to the top of Mount Arbel, which is right above Tiberias, and there were some young Jewish girls up there, and suddenly I heard one of them scream, as only a teenage girl can scream. And she was screaming the word nahash, nahash. Sure enough, I looked around. There was a little snake about this big. The Hebrew comes in handy. Keep you from being snake bitten on a mountain in Israel. I think Andy picked it up. I really do. I think he went over and picked it up. And this particular nahash, this little serpent, was about this long. The serpent that we're reading about here in chapter 4 is no such tiny little serpent, because it was something that caused Moses great fear, and it says in the text that he fled from it. Now, as we go through this book, at the book of Exodus, I want you to begin to see how almost all the acts of God, which he does among the Egyptians, they're designed to confront either the religious pantheon of Egypt, the gods and goddesses, the sorcerers and magicians, or something that has to do with the Egyptian government. It's important to see that, because what we have in Exodus is a presentation on the one hand of the truth up against the counterfeit. In this case, we have a serpent, a nahash. If you read the Egyptian literature, you'll find the word Urias. I was going to write it up here and I forgot. A Urias is the term for a cobra. The cobra was a particularly important symbol to the Egyptians because it stood for the goddess Wajet, and I've written her name here, Wajet. Wajet was the patron goddess of Lower Egypt, which is the north. She was the patron goddess of the Delta region, which includes the land of Goshen, where the Jews are living. When he chooses this particular sign, and he turns the staff into a serpent, he's choosing to use a sign that shows his power over a patron Egyptian goddess where the Jews are actually living at this time. And it was very significant. If you look at the royal crown, you may remember when we've talked about Egypt in the past, Egypt has a tendency to try to split into two countries, north and south. If you look at the north, you will see that there was a specific crown which the Pharaoh wore, which represented the north, and there was another crown which he wore, which represented the south, and then there was a crown where the two were combined, so that it showed the unification of the country. If you look at the crown for northern Egypt, it has on it a Urias. It has a cobra. It's a rearing cobra on the front of his head that kind of looks like this. Pharaoh will be wearing that crown when God turns this very staff into a cobra in chapter 7. So God follows the demonstration to Moses of this metamorphosis, I guess you could say, of the staff to a cobra by telling him to reach out and grasp the serpent's tail, which he did, and it became a staff again. You know what I was about to say? I was about to tell you that I grew up in the Arbuckle Mountains of southern Oklahoma, and that I know something about snakes. There are a lot of things I don't know anything about. I know something about snakes. You're right. You do not grab a snake by the tail. You pick it up behind the neck so that it can't bite you. It's a good insight. I think it might have been a little test of faith. See if Moses would do what God told him to do. That's one of the first things I thought of when I first read this thing. I thought, no, you don't do that. I mean, let me give you another example. What if you had to rid your home of a rabid dog? Would you grab it by the tail? No. You try to get it someplace so it couldn't turn around and bite you. So that's the first sign, the sign of the serpent. The second sign that God gives to Moses, we'll call the sign of the leprous hand. God really doesn't give Moses time to say anything here. It's like a rapid fire thing. He doesn't get a reaction back from Moses. He simply turns to the second sign and he tells Moses to put his hand in his cloak, something like this. I might have been a little bit afraid to do that for fear I'd pull a snake out of my shirt after what's just happened, but he does it, and when he pulls his hand out of his cloak, it's leprous. It's diseased. Then God says, put your hand back in your cloak and remove it, and it's healed. Here's the significance of this. This is not just something to impress people. Leprosy was widespread in Egypt, and it was considered incurable. There was no magician, no sorcerer, no god, or no goddess who was able to cure leprosy. Egypt is known for these things. I can't remember the author, but someone said that God divvied out 10 measures of sorcery to the world, and Egypt got 9 of them. So they're very well known for being able to do miraculous things, but not cure leprosy. So this sign shows them something that would have caught their eyes, but the real miracle was in the restoration. The third sign, God says, don't say anything. I've got another one for you. It's the sign of water turned to blood. So the significance of this sign, and I'm going to go into this more later when we get into the plagues, but the significance of the water turning to blood from the Nile River is that there was a god named Hapi, H-A-P-I. He's the god of the Nile River. Anything that has to do with water in Egypt reflects on Hapi. He is, in effect, the patron god of the river and of water. So when Moses is able to do this third sign and turn the water into blood, it is once again God showing his superiority over one of the Egyptian gods. So these three signs, if you think about it, the serpent is representative of Wadjet, the patron goddess of the north. God's superior because he can turn the staff into the serpent and he can turn the serpent back into a staff. The leprous hand is significant because it opposes the magicians and the sorcerers of Egypt. And God says, I'm more important and I'm more powerful than they are. The water to blood is an affront on the god Hapi. And you're going to see as we go through the book, everything God does is taking apart, like peeling an onion, the religion and the government of Egypt. Now, all three of these miracles are called signs. It's the Hebrew word oath, and it means some device that's used to point to something other than itself. It points beyond itself. And in this case, it points to the God of the Hebrews, who is sovereign over all these things. He's more powerful than Egyptian religion. He's more powerful than Egyptian government. He's more powerful than the sorcerers and magicians of Egypt. And he's also more powerful than life and death. We'll see that as we go through here. Well, what would you think Moses would do after seeing these things? He's seen the bush. He's heard the voice. He's seen the sign of the serpent, sign of the leprous hand. He didn't actually see the water turn to blood, but I think he was probably convinced it would happen. Don't you think at this point Moses would say, Lord, thank you for these signs. Thank you for clarifying for me the things I need to know, because whereas my faith was a bit weak, now that I've seen these things, you've strengthened my faith. Lord, I know you're more powerful than any challenge that you put before me. You think that's what he said? Verse 10. Then Moses said to the Lord, please, Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither recently nor in times past nor since you've spoken to your servant, for I'm slow of speech and slow of tongue. The Lord said to him, who made man's mouth? Or who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now then, go, and I'll be with your mouth and teach you what you need to say. Instead of acknowledging God's sufficiency, Moses restates two of his original objections, the doubt about his own abilities and the doubt about his reception by the elders of Israel, which is a presumption based on his complaint. It's as though nothing God has said or done between 3:11 and 4:9 has made an impression on Moses. Moses here says that he doesn't have the linguistic skill to do what God has asked him to do. I've heard if you survey the general population, the average person is more afraid of public speaking than of death. It's true. I don't know what would actually happen if they got to the guillotine, but at least when they're filling out a form, They're more afraid to get up in front of people and speak than they are of death. And the job that God has called Moses to do requires public speaking. He's going to have to speak before the elders of Israel. He's probably going to have to speak before the entire congregation of Israel. He's certainly going to have to speak before the court of Pharaoh, which would be like going before the Supreme Court. So, yeah, I understand his concern. He's been called to do something that involves public speaking. And so what does he say? He says to the Lord, he says, "I'm not a man of words." And then literally the Hebrew says, "I am heavy of mouth and heavy of tongue." He says, "I'm not eloquent." Once again, I can understand why Moses would be afraid. If you're going to be speaking to the public, wouldn't it be great if you had a wonderful Irish accent? Wouldn't that be great? Or maybe a southern drawl like S. Lewis Johnson or Billy Graham. It would just seem that it would bolster your confidence if you knew when you stood up and spoke to people that they were going to be enthralled by the beauty of your accent. I'm from Oklahoma. I can't help it. I can get away with my accent in the South, but up north it's a problem. When Linda and I moved to Ann Arbor so I could go to school at the University of Michigan, my professor was David Noel Friedman, and he had a tradition, and the tradition was he had the people in our department meet at his home every Tuesday night to read Hebrew. There were 12 of us. We would go there. The name of the class was Rapid Hebrew Reading. It should have been Massive Hebrew Reading, because each Tuesday night we were responsible for about 12 chapters somewhere in the Old Testament. And over the course of two semesters, just on Tuesday nights, we translated Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, and I think we got somewhere beyond that when the year ran out. So 10 or 12 chapters per week was not uncommon. The plan was you had to read your chapter, and you didn't know which chapter you were getting, so you couldn't cheat. You had to read your chapter aloud in Hebrew. Then you had to translate it. Then you had to know every answer for every little jot, tittle, dot, plus sign, dash, anything that was in the text. You had to be able to explain to him why it was there. Well, I was nervous. First Tuesday night at this guy's house. He's famous. I'm there with a bunch of northerners. He said, "Mr. Miller, would you read such and such a chapter?" And I read it in Hebrew. This was his first comment to me. He said, "Well, Mr. Miller, I believe that's the first time I've ever heard Hebrew read with a southern accent." I replied, "Judean dialect, sir." If you get that, wonderful. If you don't, it's not worth the time to try to figure it out. But he liked me from that point on, accent and all. Commentators have speculated about what was wrong with Moses. Did he stutter? Maybe he didn't know Hebrew. Possibly. Had his facility in the Egyptian language languished after 40 years in Midian? We just don't know. But what we do know is that God is a patient God. And I love his reply to Moses. He says, "Moses, think a minute. Quit talking and complaining for just a second. Who made man's mouth? Who makes his ears hear and his eyes see? Is it not I, the Lord?" There's an implication here, "and makes his tongue speak." This not only puts Moses' complaint in perspective. What are these little objections compared to who I am and what I do? But it teaches us that God is not only in control of the forces of nature, he's not only sovereign over Egypt, he's not only sovereign over the gods and the magicians of this great land, Egypt, but he's in control of his messengers as well. Now, there's a subtle play on words in the Hebrew text that you would never pick up in English, and I'll simply say that there's an interplay in these verses here between Moses and God with regard to the Hebrew pronoun anoti, which means I, like I, not this kind of I, but I, like I am. It's a battle of pronouns, if you will, and it's the reason you don't get it in English is it has to do with where they're placed in the syntax of the Hebrew sentences. Twice in verse 10, Moses says, "Am I not eloquent, and am I not slow of tongue?" Then God, on the other hand, after pointing out that it's He who made the mouth and who gives man his abilities, in verse 10 He says, "Is it not I, the Lord, who do these things?" The issue is which I is in control. Is this about Moses, or is this about God's plan for Moses? Moses is assuming in all these objections that it is he who's going to play the central role in the delivery of the Israelites. But God's perspective is different from this. God has already referred to Israel as my people. Moses doesn't understand. God cares more about the deliverance of the Israelites from Egypt and their placement in the land of Canaan in fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant than Moses does. God's fully capable of doing these things. Moses is just the instrument that he's going to use. Moses is just an ordinary man with very ordinary parents. He was reared in an extraordinary set of circumstances, and yet he's subject to the very failings of any human being. But God's not ordinary. And it's going to be God, not Moses, who brings these things about and brings Israel out of Egypt. Moses is his instrument. Then the Lord ends his response with a command. "Therefore, go." Oh, Moses should have listened at that point. Surely, though, he gets it. He's going to believe now and obey, right? After God's commanded him to go. Verse 13. Well, we know there's a problem because verse 13 begins with the word "but." "But he said, 'Please, Lord, now send the message by whomever you will.'" I'll talk about this in a minute. That's a weird construction in Hebrew. Verse 14. "Then the anger of the Lord burned against Moses, and he said, 'Is there not your brother? Is there not your brother Aaron the Levite? I know that he speaks fluently. And moreover, behold, he's coming out to meet you. And when he sees you, he'll be glad in his heart. You're to speak to him and put words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth. And I'll teach you what you're to do. Moreover, he shall speak for you to the people, and it shall come about that he shall be as a mouth to you, and you shall be as a God to him. You shall take in your hand this staff with which you shall perform the signs." By the way, that's a dismissive phrase there. It's like, don't forget your staff. There's something here that you should not miss. Moses has run out of logical excuses. It's obvious. But I told you early, he's a smart man. At least he is smart enough not to turn to a totally illogical argument to try to make this final attempt to extricate himself from God's commission. Let me give you an example of a totally illogical argument. When my son was 15 years old, what a joy it is to be the parent of a 15-year-old child. My son was equivocating about taking Spanish or Latin in high school. I wanted him to take Latin because I thought it would be helpful to him in college. He wanted to take Spanish because he thought it would be easier. I told him that in my high school, all the cute girls took Latin. He didn't believe me. So I came up with an alternative argument. I thought for sure that one would get him. It didn't work. I said, "Look, Jason, if you'll take Latin, I'll work with you through your textbook. I'll help you. I'll make sure you understand exactly what's going on in each chapter, and you'll be prepared for every test that you have to take." You know, it's a father-son bonding opportunity. Sounded pretty good to me. So he took Latin. Keep in mind we're talking here about an illogical argument. Don't forget that. A few weeks into the semester, Latin started to get hard. I'm sure Spanish got hard too, but he wasn't taking Spanish. He was taking Latin. He only knew Latin was getting hard. So he started whining to me about transferring out of Latin into Spanish. And when I wouldn't budge, as a last resort, he looked me in the eye and he said, "Dad, you just don't get it. Latin's a lot harder now than when you took it." Let me tell you, before the last word got out of his mouth, even a 15-year-old teenage boy who's pleading for his life here, I could tell he realized, boy, have I made a big blunder. I don't even believe this. I know my dad's not going to believe me. Well, I mentioned that Moses is smart. He was smart enough not to make an argument like that to God. So what does he do? Well, he just says no. He refuses. Verse 13 is kind of hard to translate. You can understand it like this, though. He says, "Please, Lord, now send the message by whomever you will, and what you have to supply there is accept me. Send anyone you want to, accept me." You may also notice in that sentence that the word Lord is spelled capital L, little O-R-D. It's not spelled with all capital letters. If it were spelled with all capital letters, you could assume that the Hebrew word that's being translated Lord is Yahweh, which is goes back to our lesson last week about the self-existent, powerful God. When it's spelled the way it's spelled here, the Hebrew word is Adonai. It means sir. Seems Moses can't bring himself to use the name of the great I Am in this sentence, because to do so would be an acknowledgement that God is able to do what he wants to do through Moses. So he chooses a different word here. I think to all of our surprise, up until this point, God's been very patient with Moses. He's answered every complaint. But in 14, we read, "And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses." Now, I want you to keep something in mind. Ideally, we would have had a lesson that went from 3:1 through 4:17. It would have lasted about 3.5 hours, because that would preserve the unity of this section for you. What I want you to remember is Moses is still standing at the burning bush. Now, it's been weeks since we talked about a burning bush. Moses is still standing there. He's talking to God, whose voice is audibly coming out of the flames of the bush, who's addressing Moses and giving him this commission. Moses is objecting to God at the very time that he's standing in front of the burning bush in the midst of a theophany. Nevertheless, God doesn't strike down Moses at this point. He accommodates him to a degree. But it's not an accommodation without a price. He says, "You know, Moses, I was willing to do all this through you, you alone. But now, I guess we're going to involve Aaron." The price is that it would be legitimate to presume there is some reward waiting for Moses for being a faithful servant in what God's called him to do. Now that's going to be shared with his brother Aaron. Moses gives up something. Now, the relationship that God establishes between Moses and Aaron is something that's always been interesting to me. Moses will speak to Aaron. He'll put the words in Aaron's ears that God has spoken to him. And then Aaron will, in turn, speak those words to the elders of Israel and to Pharaoh. Here's the literal rendering of the text. "He will be to you as a mouth." That is, he will say what you tell him to say. "You will be to him as an Elohim," as a God. We'll spell that with a lowercase g. I would have. They don't in here, but I would have. "You will be as a God." That is, you will be the source, as far as he's concerned, of what he's going to say. Later in chapter 7, when we get over there, we'll learn a little bit about the role of a prophet. Moses, at that point, at the end of chapter 6, he's still complaining about, believe it or not, still complaining about this. And God says in 7:1, then the Lord said to Moses, see, I'm making you as a god to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron will be your prophet. So a prophet is a human instrument that God uses to take the word of God to the people. And Moses stands in the role of a god to this prophet Aaron, because he stands as the source of what Aaron hears and repeats. Well, I have a few concluding remarks this morning. I think there are some lessons. When we refuse to do what God has called us to do, the plan of God is not going to be frustrated. He'll accomplish his plan in obedience and in disobedience. But there's a loss to us. The reward that we might think that results from faithful service is lost. And there's another thing. Though we should never be arrogant or think too highly of ourselves, there's also a danger of thinking too little of yourself. And that's one of the traps that Moses falls into here. It's that thing Andy talked about today that is the relationship between divine sovereignty and human responsibility. They are both in play. So when I say this, I'm not in any way implying that we should depend on our own talents at all to do the work of God to the exclusion of his enablement. That would be wrong. But we have to understand that God is capable of taking very little and turning it into something great, something that could never be apart from him. In Israel, we stood at the place that tradition says Jesus fed the 5,000. No one knows exactly where that was, but we were close to that place. 5 loaves, 2 fish. What can a man do with so little against the great challenge of feeding a multitude of men and women? Well, a man can't meet that challenge. He can't do it. But when a man bends to the will of God, to the call that God's given him, God can do great things. I want you to consider another man, a man who lived some 700 years after Moses, a man who very likely had no more innate talents or abilities than Moses. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. We don't know. It's not the point. The point is this. I want to read something to you, and I want you to listen to the difference in this response and the response that Moses has been giving to God. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having 6 wings. With 2 he covered his face, with 2 he covered his feet, with 2 he flew. One called out to another, and he said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is filled with his glory. And the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out while the temple was filling with smoke. Then he said, woe is me, for I'm ruined, because I'm a man of unclean lips. And I live among a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a burning coal in his hand, which he had taken from the altar with tongs. And he touched my mouth with it, and he said, behold, this has touched your lips. Your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is forgiven. Listen to this verse. Then I heard a voice from the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? And then I said, here am I. Send me. This is the call of Isaiah. And it is, in essence, the same call that God gave to Moses. Notice Isaiah doesn't necessarily jump for joy and say, oh yeah, I've been waiting for you to call me to do this. I'm ready to go. He doesn't do that. When he's given a vision of God's holiness, he's humbled. It's a divine vision, not that different from the burning bush. Isaiah acknowledges that he's unworthy for the call. That's a correct response, by the way. I mean, for Isaiah or for Moses or for you or for me, we're not worthy of God's call. He recognizes his sin in verse 5 here, and it's followed by a purging and forgiveness in verses 6 and 7. And then God gives Isaiah the call, and he says, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" And Isaiah's answer is, "Here am I, send me." Let me also remind you of Paul's words over in 2 Corinthians chapters 2 and 3. He's in this section, he's comparing the old and the new covenants, and Paul's discussing his apostolic ministry in chapter 2, and in verse 16 of that chapter, he asks this question: who is sufficient for these things? Who's sufficient for this calling? Verses 5 and 6 of chapter 3, he answers his own question. He says, "We're not adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves, but our adequacy is from God who made us servants of the new covenant." In recognizing the disparity between human inability and divine enablement, and by responding to God's call with a willingness to serve, we strike a balance between God asking us to do something and our own human limitations. The issue is less about our ability or inability and more about the willingness to serve. Your responsibility and mine is to say, "Here am I, send me." God's responsibility is to empower and enable us, if he calls us, to do whatever he's asked us to do. That's how Moses should have responded to the call of God. One thing about the Bible, it doesn't attempt to sugarcoat a lot of things. Pretty well tells the truth.